Hey, Murray.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, very well. Are you? Do you have pants?
Hold on a second.
Do you have pants on? So,
well, if he doesn't, let's do a Zoom call in, Chen.
Sound good?
Yeah, you sound really good. You sound like you're 20 and full of vigor.
Well, I'm wearing a headset, so I just want to make sure.
Yeah, can you hear us okay?
A little louder you guys could be, because I'm pretty good loud.
Stop telling us what to do. See, he used to be my boss at Warner Brothers.
He's living it up.
So he naturally just tells me what to do. Right. It just comes natural to him.
You make yourself louder, you guys.
He's working on it right now. Ladies and gentlemen, Murray Nagel.
Hi, guys.
That was your cue. Oh, my goodness. So, Murray, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Okay, good.
Well, a little allergies today. The allergies are high, but I'm okay.
Okay, well, you're with L.A. Lloyd and Chewy, our producer.
What's up, Murray?
Hi, guys.
So, Murray, how did you get started in the music business? And do you remember your first song that you promoted as a promotion man for Warner Brother Records?
How I got the music business, right place, right time. You know, I dropped out of college. I went to Los Angeles, roamed around there. I went to the Whiskey Go-Go and saw the groups out there, Love, and so on. Then I came back to Cleveland by 68. And my cousin, Sheldon Turk, ran the Mercury Record distributorship there, you know, the branch. And he hired me as an inventory clerk. Now, so I was doing the inventory clerk there, and I was like 19, 20 years old or whatever, and music was changing. You know, rock and roll was really coming into a big thing, and all the labels were starting to sign rock and roll bands. So the promotion people that were in at that time were like from the early 60s, late 50s, whatever, suit and ties, I remember what they used to wear. And when the rock and roll groups came in town, I was always asked to take them around to do the interviews so I could relate. And living in Cleveland was a big breakout market rock and roll city. You had incredible radio, pop radio stations there from Wixie and was a top 40 major station. And then CKLW from Detroit was like the number two station in Cleveland, Ohio.
Isn't that crazy?
So, and you had great clubs there. You had great urban club called Leo's Casino. And they would break a lot of records through the Whammo on their R&B side. And then you had clubs, you know, Le Cave and Agora opened up in Cleveland, right by Cleveland.
That was famous, the Agora Ballroom.
Yeah, and then you had FM stations starting to come in there.
The progressive FM stations.
Yeah, and they were called FM. And that's when they started playing freeform albums. There was no control. They could play deep cuts and deep, you know.
Hey, you know what, Murray? We had John Anderson, the lead singer of Yes, on our podcast. And Fragile became such a huge album. And we were kind of talking to him about how he was at the right place at the right time with that album, with those songs being 11 minutes, 13 minutes, because progressive rock radio were okay playing that, you know, that type, that length of song, and sometimes they'd play a whole side of an album.
Plus, DJs needed to go pee occasionally.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you got to remember,
In the Gata Da Vida was the poop song, wasn't it?
What?
I was commenting to L.A. Lloyd. Wasn't In the Gata Da Vida the song every DJ went to go potty?
Yeah, I had to go take a poop.
Yeah, the In the Gata Da Vida had the long version, and the other one was Vanilla Fudge.
Oh, yeah. You keep me hanging on. I played drums to that in the band. I love
like
that song.
Yes,
it was.
But the FM stations were playing that type of music. Cleveland was just incredible. You had the Upbeat show that record companies were sending groups in. It was a syndicated show.
Wow.
So what happened is that I started slotting in and started working more and more with the rock and roll bands because the older promotion people there were used to working the Frank Sinatras and the Paul Ankas and Perry Como's and those records.
Yeah.
And then rock and roll broke wide open. And I mean, I went to a Beatles show, and one of the first records I really worked was like an artist by the name of Bobby Hebb, and the song he had was Sonny. And you remember that?
Sonny. Thank you for the... Right. So wait a minute, Murray, hold on. You saw the Beatles? Did you see the Beatles play? Did you actually see them perform?
Yes. Sonny, Bobby had opened up for the Beatles in Cleveland, Ohio.
No way.
Yeah, the Cleveland Stadium, and I saw the Beatles there.
Wow.
Bobby Hebb was on the show.
Wow.
So I was fortunate to see the whole Beatles live, and unfortunately, it was at a stadium, so I didn't have the best seat. I was the first row, but unfortunately, they played like in the infield, so you were never really that close.
Right.
And then the kids climbed all over and ran towards the stage.
Mayhem.
But yes, Bobby Hebb opened up. But that was probably one of the first records, Sonny, that I took Bobby Hebb around. And then Mercury, then they decided to send me to Pittsburgh, Mercury Records. You know, they closed the branch, and then a distributor opened up, and I went to work in Pittsburgh, which changed my whole life. Because Mercury Records, the distributor, I forget what it was called, they fired me and told me my record career was over. And then about 2-3 weeks later, I get a call from the distributor there, ArcJK, which was based out of Detroit.
I worked there. I worked at ArcJK Handelman. And Handelman was the distributor for all the Corvette stores, which then became Kmarts. So we would ship their songs to all the Kmarts around the country when they were ordering music.
Besides that, they were a big rack jobber, you know, with all the Kmarts and Walmarts or whatever the big box stores were.
Right.
But they also, in Pittsburgh, they handled just about any line that was in Pittsburgh, so if Detroit didn't have it, they could still ship it to the Handelman branch there to ship out to the One Stop. So I got hired there, and I handled Warner Brothers, Elektra Records, Atlantic Records, Fantasy Records. I mean, you go down the list, ABC, Dunhill. I mean, I went down the list, and I always had hot records to take to the radio stations, and then you had the FM stations that weren't, you know, they weren't called AOR, Album Oriented Radio yet. They were still, but I had KQV that broke a lot of records. You know, I had Deep Purple, Black Knight, that was like a top 10 record in Pittsburgh that never spread anyplace else, but that was a big record in Pittsburgh. And so when Warner Elektra Atlantic decided to open up their own branches around the country. They were all owned by, at that time, the Kinney Corporation, Warner Elektra Atlantic. So I was hired there from the Cleveland branch, and I was a triple bagger. I left ArcJK, and I was a triple bagger, which meant I handled Warner Brothers, Elektra, and Atlantic Records.
Wow.
And I have to tell you, I worked with all, I mean, I had all those great records, you know, that you're working on Warner Brothers, Atlantic Records, from the Rolling Stones when they had it. And I had such great records, you know, Van Morrison, Warner Brothers, you know, I mean, It was.
Did you have the Eagles?
The right place, right time.
Did you have the Eagles?
Pardon?
Did you have the Eagles also? I mean, on Elektra at that time, or were they assigned to Asylum at that time?
Not really. I had like records like Bread and the New Seekers and Top
Bread
records.
I Want to Make It with You, Bread. I remember that song.
The David Gates and Bread and New Seekers. That was like the Pepsi commercial or something.
Hey, Murray, can you explain that song, Baby, I'ma Want You? I never understood what the hell that meant.
Baby, I want you.
I never understood those lyrics.
Baby, I want you. Baby, I need you.
Anyways, I had a lot of records, and I worked for great people at the three labels. I mean, Jerry Greenberg, Dickie Klein, and Vince Ceracy at Atlantic Records. Great people. Jerry Greenberg ended up being president of Atlantic, and then he was president of Michael Jackson's label and everything. And then Ron Saul was the national promotion man for Warner Brothers. And him and I got very close, and I liked his style and everything. And he asked me to move to Detroit.
Lucky you. Cleveland to Pittsburgh to Detroit. All real happening cities.
Right. And they were all hot markets. And in Pittsburgh, you had Chuck Brinkman at KQB. Let him rest in peace, but was a great guy. And he, and I had a great relationship, and he broke a lot of records. And, and then I moved to Detroit. And at that time, that was a hotbed for top 40 radio. CKLW was the powerhouse.
Yeah.
And what a legend was the music director at Rosalie Trumbly.
Yeah.
And Fred could tell you about that too. But she was fabulous. And then you had Keener top 40, WKNR. And then you had another top 40, WCAR, with Paul Christie there. And then you had the incredible WABX FM radio that played album-oriented radio that was a hotbed and a major FM station that broke a lot of rock records. And then on top of that, you had the Canadian CHOM. Is that it, Fred?
I think so. But
CJOM?
Yeah, I think so. But it was CKLW that clearly was just this booming radio station.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, they broke. She loved taking care of the promotion, man. She liked them. She would help everybody out. Everybody got a break from her and breaking records. And now I'm working exclusively at Warner Brothers. But I'll give you a go back to a couple of great stories about some Warner Brothers artists I worked with. We signed Grateful Dead. The first album was American Beauty. I was living in Pittsburgh at the time and promoting, the Three Bags, and Grateful Dead was a project that we were all flown to Chicago, and for the first album, they wanted to really kick it off big. So somehow or another, and I can't remember because it's in the 70s, that somehow or another, I got a parade permit on Forbes Avenue. And if you're familiar with Pittsburgh, Forbes Avenue is a major street. It's where the baseball stadium was, University of Pittsburgh was on the street, and a good old-fashioned record store, independent record store. So somehow or another, I came up with the idea, and I had a kid that was like an intern for me, a friend, and it was at a fraternity. So I decided to set up the parade, and we got a hearse. And I got some kids from the security house to get them like tuxedos, and white face, and they carried the casket full of Grateful Dead records down Forbes Avenue.
Oh, my goodness.
And we had signs and the hearse and everything else, and we went to the record store. And that was one of the promotions that was a big promotion in Pittsburgh. They got written up and everything else in that. And to this day, I still can't remember how I got a parade permit for that. But then, anyways, going back to Detroit, which was a great, great radio station, great great FM stage with ABX station, and you had the Grandy Ballroom, and you had Cobo Hall.
So when you moved to Detroit, do you remember the first band that you had worked for Warner Brothers?
Well, the first band that I really, really worked with, there were so many in the early days, with Van Morrison and Grateful Dead, Black Sabbath, Faces, Jethro Tull, Joni Mitchell, James Taylor. You know, I worked with Fleetwood Mac with in the way early days. With them doing the college markets and doing those type of things and playing small clubs with Peter Green at the time. And going back, and, you know, there was just a lot of things happening in the right place, right time, like I said.
How about Alice Cooper, Murray? Did you work with Alice at all?
Alice Cooper was one of my favorite bands to work with because of management, you know. Jeff Gordon managed Alice Cooper. Great guy to work with. And at that time, A-Team was breaking out of Detroit with David Urso. And then I lived in Pittsburgh at the time, and KQV added it, and then I think WLS in Chicago added it, and it became a gigantic record.
All right, so let me ask you a question, Murray. When you first went to see Alice Cooper perform live, did he do the guillotine and the whole shtick of what he did? And if so, what did you think when you first saw him? Like, I mean, I can only imagine you've never seen him play, so you see him. What was that like?
Well, it was all like seeing a play. It was all theatrical. It was probably, you know, one of the first musical type a theatrical play.
Right.
I mean, he had the guillotine, he brought out the snake, played, you know, the songs, and it was great. And he was a good person. In fact, we threw a gigantic party with him and in Detroit and the Pontchartrain Hotel. You remember that one, Fred?
Oh, my God. We had Bob Marley there for dinner. We had a lot of crazy bands in that hotel.
Cobo Hall.
Yeah.
So when he played Cobo Hall, then we had a party afterward and a whole circus we created in there. I mean, we had every type of circus act in there. And it was just a blast because it all goes back to management, the accessibility of with your artists and promoters. And that was one that you would love working with Alice Cooper because he would do anything for you because of the management would okay it. Right. There was one story with Alice that I picked up Rosalie Trumbly, who was a music director at CKLW, son at a high school in a limousine with Alice Cooper.
Alice told us that very story, Murray. Sure we had Alice as a guest, and he told us that exact story and that he actually even played their high school dance or something, right?
Yeah.
Alice Cooper.
I mean, when he got out of the car to say hello to Rosalie's son and getting in a limo, all these kids went nuts, you know?
So let me ask you another question. In Michigan, one of the biggest bands that came out of there was Bob Seger. And before he went and signed a record deal with Capitol, he was on a baby label called Palladium that was distributed by Warner Brothers. Is that correct?
Faces, correct.
So tell us a Bob Seger story.
The Bob Seger story?
I mean,
well,
do you have one?
Bob Seger and Punch Andrews, the manager, had their own label called Palladium Records that we distributed. And at that time, Bob was just starting out. And they were breaking out of Detroit.
Was it Ramblin' Gamblin' Man? do you think? Was it Ramblin' Gamblin' Man? Or I can't remember his...
Love that song.
Lloyd, do you remember his first hits? I can't remember.
That was definitely one of the first ones. I don't know if it was the first or not, but that was a great one.
It was a great one.
He was getting good play on ABX and starting off in that. He even had... he wrote a song about Rosalie Trumbly.
Yeah.
You got the power, you got the tower.
Right.
You know, he wrote about her, and he started kicking off and getting, you know, starting off. But at Palladium, it didn't really kick off with us, with them, until he went to, I think, Capitol, where he had his big hits.
Yeah, right. You know, Beautiful Loser and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just starting off. It didn't break big, but then they and the Palladium deal didn't work out. So he went to Capitol and became, you know, a gigantic star.
So
if you go back to Detroit and the artists that were big, you know, Neil Young, because of the Canadian content that had restrictions. That they had to play certain amounts on CKLW,
10%
Canadian artists. So, like Gordon Lightfoot would break out. If you could read my mind, and
one of Lloyd's favorite
old man, and songs like that were really very started, you know, early in Detroit because of Neil Young Canadian content and stuff like that.
So Lloyd has this burning. Lloyd has this burning question about what the groupies look like for Gordon Lightfoot.
you want to know what the groupies were.
For Gordon Lightfoot, mostly. If you could read my mind.
Oh, man.
Sundown.
A lot of Birkenstock.
Hairy armpits.
The groupies in Pittsburgh were probably the best.
Really?
Because I had a great roommate who worked for United Artists at the time. And I worked at the Triple Bagger at Warner's. So we had an incredible time, and there were groupies there. And the best story I can tell you was about Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
Oh, good. Let's hear it.
Lucky man. I told you I was a Triple Bagger, so I handled Atlantic Records. And Emerson, Lake, and Palmer was on one of their labels. And KQB was breaking Lucky Man.
Huge
and
song.
It was really big in Pittsburgh.
Huge.
So they did a show in Pittsburgh, and I had a party afterwards, and all the groupies showed up and whatever. So a buddy of mine, you're going to love this story, that works at RCA, and his name was Don Whittemore. So I had a suite, and the groupies were there. So I asked him, I said, Dad, I need your room. So I got his key, brought over the Emerson, Lake, and Palmer guy. The groupies or whatever. They got in there. And whatever happened, happened. But the next day I get a call from Don Whittemore, and they said, my Buck Owens watch is missing. That was missing. Somehow or another, I got it back for him. That was the funniest story.
My Buck Owens watch.
He carried out his room. His Buck Owens watch was missing. So I got it back.
Well, I'm glad you explained Triple Bagger there, because I thought that's when, you know, you get women so ugly that you had to put three bags over your face so you didn't see them the next morning, you know.
Your face, not theirs. Hey, Murray.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
So then, you know, obviously the rock and roll business really started to get a lot of momentum. The progressive stations were really kicking in and starting to sell a lot of records. And all of a sudden, you've got like Todd Rundgren and Foghat on Bearsville. You've got Fleetwood Mac continually growing and growing on the Warner label. Neil Young was on Reprise. Go ahead.
With ABX, you're getting a lot of album cut plays, deep cuts. That was another freeform radio. And you had some great jocks there. And, you know, and it was, and Detroit, you forget about the Grandy Ballroom, how many people played there.
Led Zeppelin, you know? The Who, MC5.
Everybody played. Yeah, there was those three clubs, I mean, across the country. That, you know, the Fillmore East, Fillmore West, Grandy Ballroom, the Warehouse in New Orleans, you know?
Hey, Murray, when you were triple bagging, did you work the MC5 Kick Out the Jams song?
No.
Okay.
No. Jack Holtzman, Jack Holtzman left Elektra.
Yeah.
You know, who was the person that went back and signed the Doors. You know, I worked the Doors records.
Nice.
You know, in the early days of the Doors.
What was the big hit you worked?
I saw the Doors at Whiskey and Go-Go.
Wow. What was the song you were working?
I mean, I'll go back. So after Detroit, Ron Stahl, which was great and everything.
Murray.
I went, he wanted me to move to L.A. And I took Dave Ursel's place in Detroit. And Dave was doing Southern California. And Dave wanted to get into Irish relations, and I'll explain that in a little bit. So I moved to Southern California, and this is the territory for a local guy, is San Diego, Phoenix, Tucson, Las Vegas, and Los Angeles.
Oh, my God.
And the secondary markets, you know, and that type of thing. And you had the RKO headquarters there with KHJ was there, and the KCBQ in San Diego breaking records. I mean, it was just a hot market. And then you had another fantastic FM station called KMET.
Oh, yeah.
Which had great jacks, had a great following, great numbers. And you also had the station KLOS. Yeah, it was ABC owned then. And then you had the Long Beach station, which is great because Fred, I don't know if you ever know this one. I can't remember the station in Long Beach.
KNAC.
But on April 1st, April Fool's Day, they would let the promotion man do an hour radio show live.
Nice.
And the only restriction you had, you could not play any music on your label.
Oh, that's kind of
so
cool.
It was great. He taped you, and we were on the radio for an hour. And the artist I was really in love with, and he passed away, was Emmett Rhodes. I was a big fan of Emmett Rhodes. And I played a lot of records by Emmett Rhodes and, you know, that type of thing. But working Southern California with home offices there, you had all the home offices in Capitol and Warner Brothers. And Elektra Records was there, and it was high profile.
Did you meet Jim Morrison or Ray Manzarek or any of those guys from the Doors? Did you get to spend any time with them?
Well, the Doors, I saw the Doors earlier on that way, and then I saw the Doors in Detroit there too.
What was the song that you worked for the Doors?
For which one? For what group?
The Doors.
Oh, the Doors. I worked, L.A. Woman. I think it was Light My Fire and some of those type of things by the Doors. That was in Pittsburgh. So I was a triple bagger for the Doors. But when I went to Warner Brothers, I was exclusively Warner Brothers in Detroit and Southern California.
What was the first gold record or platinum record you got from Warner Brothers?
The first gold record I got was a Grateful Dead.
Really?
American Beauty.
Wow.
Back then it was on,
and
I think, then, white linen.
And I worked Black Sabbath. Iron Man.
Iron Man.
I love that song to this day. Iron Man. And I worked that in Pittsburgh. But I got to tell you another thing that when you had, and I listened to Paul Fishkin, I have to tell you another story about Foghat with them. One of the most successful reasons that group really broke was the management and Paul Fishkin. Because that was another management would let you do anything with Foghat. It was like if a retail chain was doing their convention, which I had in Pittsburgh, that National Record Mart, they had like 130 stores based out of Pittsburgh. They were having a convention for their managers, and we had Foghat play it there. And that, and when Paul was talking about they would do anything in travel and the support, I have to tell you, Tony Otito and Paul Fishkin were right there for you to do whatever you wanted. I mean, I remember after, you know, doing California and running around them and, you know, with Bears Bill and, you know, and Paul talking about Todd Rundgren. I used to have an answering service. Whatever priority record I answered, I was working. They would answer the phone. Hello, it's me. Or when I was working Maria Muldaur, it would be Midnight at the Oasis. You know, so I would always have the, and they were live people in those days, answering service. There was no machine.
Oh, that's right.
So I always loved to answer the phone that way. So after working California and, you know, being involved in a lot of acts and some on stories, I have a great story about, I have two stories I want to talk about. Russ Thyrett, who was the chairman of our company that just recently passed away. The first story I got to tell about how I met him in Detroit, Fred, you'll love this story. So he came in, and he was national sales guy. And he came to Detroit, and he said, hey, I'd like to run with you to some accounts. So I said, okay. So the first account we were going to was Angott's. It was a one-stop that sold to the retail chains and jute boxes and so on. So I was 22 years old, and I drew a blank at what street to get off on the freeway, Fred, in Detroit. So finally, I went up and down the street, and Russ, the first time I met him, Fred, he looked at me, he said, you must think I'm stupid. You're going up and down the street, and you don't know where you're going. He says, why don't you get off and call them and get the address? So I'm freaking out. You know, I got the boss in town. I'm a nervous wreck. So I get off the phone. I get off the freeway, get to a payphone, call him, get the right exit. You know, I couldn't remember the exit. So I get there, go to the store, go to the outlet, and got. I walk in, and everybody, hi, Murray, how you doing, whatever. And the owner even came out.
Saved.
You know, Mia, boss and everything. So it was really good. So walking out, and Russ looked at me, says, you know, you might not know how to get to a place, but you know what to do when you do get to a place.
Nice. And great.
That started a friendship that lasted a lifelong until he passed away. We stayed close all the way. And then the second story, when I lived in L.A., Russ was very creative and with all the acts, and they loved him and this and that, and he was a national sales. So Russ went to London for a meeting or something. And I don't know if everybody's familiar with pirate radio in London at the time. You know, you had the BBC stations, but pirate radio was broadcasting into London and around the area through a boat. They would be docked out 2 miles or 3 miles limit or whatever, and they had a tower on the boat. They would broadcast records, you know, and they would broadcast a lot of major artist albums, you know, and breaking them out so you didn't have to just deal with the BBC and their channels. So Russ met the guy, the top jock there, and brought him back to L.A. And he got the studio, at our office was right on the studio lot. So Russ booked the studio for this guy to broadcast the tape Warner Brothers acts. So, you know, he booked, you know, every act that he could get there, if it was Fleetwood Mac or, you know, Van Halen or whatever, for London to be broadcast on live. On the pirate radio. Wow. So he and if you remember the TV show Kung Fu, Peter Carradine, he met on the studio lot. and he interviewed David Carradine from Kung Fu, and that was great and everything. So there was a concert, and I can't remember the artist that Russ and I were going to take him to the Forum to see. So we went in the limousine, and you're going to love this story. We went into it with the limousine and went and saw the show. We went backstage, and the jock disappeared. We couldn't find him, so, okay, imagine he went that. Someplace else. Then. So then it was right after the show. It was late. The whole parking lot was empty. We go look for our limousine driver. We couldn't find him. And you had no cell phones at the time. Everything got locked up. Russ and I are in the middle of the parking lot. We're trying to figure out how to get a cab or whatever. Then these two girls walked out. And there was the one car was in the parking lot was a Volkswagen Beetle. So Russ is a pretty big guy. And him and I asked the girls if they could take us into, you know, Hollywood, the Sunset Strip, where I lived at the time. And they said, sure. So we got into the car. They got dropped off. Then we finally found out what the guy, where he disappeared.
Where did he go?
He ran into David Carradine at the concert, took our limousine with him, and went to a party.
There you have it.
How's that for a classic, huh?
Yeah.
Hey, Murray, tell us a Prince story, because you were with Prince in the very beginning and spent a lot of time with him, right?
Yeah. Okay. The funny thing about Prince was Russ was involved in signing Prince. And what brought to him was a local promotion man that was friend with Owen Huxley that managed Prince at the time. So Russ got Prince signed. And I was close with Russ and any project he took on, I really wanted to help out. And we had a song called I Want to Be Your Lover, the first single out by Prince. So I talked to Russ. I said, I want to do a promotional tour with him. So he's sure. So we took him into the Dallas. Oh, I got to go back a little bit. After my L.A. stint out there doing local, Russ became vice president of marketing and promotion. And Don McGregor, who was running the marketing in Southwest, moved out to L.A. And Ron Saul left Warner Brothers. Gary Davis took his place. Don McGregor, who was regional out of Dallas, and David Urso was doing Irish Relations, but was a great promotion man also. So Gary Davis hired both of them, and I was out of the Los Angeles as promotion man, and they wanted to bring somebody in, and Russ hired me to do the regional marketing in the Southwest. So it came on that I had the staff, and then I'll tell you stories about Fred. And I had a good promotion staff working in the Southwest. So could I handle Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Mississippi, and so on? So, Prince, I Want to Be Your Lover, we started getting some airplay, some magic in Houston, which was really like the number one urban station there. So I brought him around to Dallas, and we did radio and flew with him. And went to Houston, and then went to New Orleans, to all radio. And the true story is that he had a mystique about him, but we all knew he was special. So we did Prince, and we went to Magic. Now, you got to understand, a number one station in the market, the guy got him, takes him into the studio live, right when we're there, which rarely happens, with the jock in the air, and wants to talk to Prince. Prince wouldn't talk on the radio station.
He just sat there? He just sat there and did nothing?
He was being asked questions, and he wouldn't answer. Quiet. Or he would date yes or no. You know, there was no dialogue. So I said, oh, my God, this is what I'm dealing with. Now, you ought to understand, we're going to New Orleans next. I'm sitting next to him in a plane. For 3 days, he never said a word to me. I said, after 3 days, I didn't even know if he knew who I was. You know, me, him, and his manager. So we get to New Orleans and did the same thing. I'm having breakfast with the manager, and Prince comes down to have breakfast, and he says, "Hi, Murray." And I said, "What? You know my name? You speak to me?" I mean, traveling with somebody, he had a mystique about him.
All right, we have to close the show up a little bit. Can you close it with maybe a Fleetwood Mac story?
Well, I got a better story for that one about Prince.
Okay.
So after that, we started really getting some airplay and everything. We worked out a deal that we were going to do like a dollar show or whatever and tie in with radio, and worked it out. So I went to Danny Eaton, who was a promoter for 462 and a friend of mine, and I said, "Listen, I'd like to book one of these cheap shows and have Prince play there live," and Russ gave me the budget to do it. He says, "No problem." So we did it, and he booked, and he played a country and western club at Skillman Avenue in Dallas, that Danny Eaton says, "It's the only place I can book." And I had to rent a trailer as a dressing room for Prince.
Jeez.
And he played the club. It was packed. And when everybody saw him play live, it was so, so special. It still gives me chills up my back.
Wow.
The music and the talent he had and the stage presence was great.
Yeah.
And we did Austin and we did Houston, the same type of shows. And if I tell you, you knew he was special and everybody saw him, knew he was going to be a star. I mean, that's how good he was. That was one of my favorite artists to work. I mean, some of the best managers were Eddie Loeffler with Van Halen, worked with them from the beginning, and they had a different manager at the time. But Ed Loeffler, let him rest in peace, he is another great manager that helped Van Halen's career. You know, just like Chef Gordon did for Alice Cooper, you know, Tony Otita did for Foghat. You had some great managers that I worked with over the years that got what promotion people did and would say, like, "Okay, let's go on the road. Let's do promotional tours." You know, and that was the fun of it, that a manager would really know what promotion men did. You know, when they saw the passion, how you love their records, it was fabulous that you could work with a manager. And now I'm going to come to Fred Byers. That was one of the gifts that Fred had, was with an artist, was the passion. If he loved a record, you went after it. That's a promotion person, what he would do.
I think Lloyd threw me out once.
What?
I think Lloyd threw me out of his radio station once or twice. Maybe twice.
Yeah. He's passionate, all right.
Yeah, I mean, that we had great promotion in Dallas and Houston and New Orleans. But, you know, since Fred's with the interview, is that there are some great fun times that Fred and I had traveling together or doing whatever. But, you know, really worked the records. And I came from sales and promotion that I could coordinate the retail chains to back up Fred if he got airplay. So I could get records into the marketplace, being the regional marketing director, and also take his enthusiasm and, you know, and capitalize on it. I mean, he could drive you crazy with it, but, you know, it was fun because you knew he was going to do his best to deliver a record.
So I got to tell this story. I have to tell a story. Remember when Southwest Airlines, in the very beginning of the plane, when you'd walk in, they would have the seats facing each other. So if you're on the first row of Southwest Airlines, those two seats to the left or to the right face the whole aircraft. And then all the other, you know, seats were facing forward. So me and Murray get in the first seats, and there's ladies across from us. And I'm 23, 24, skinny, long hair. And Murray convinces these girls that I'm about to marry a woman in her 50s. You know, and I have to kind of go along with this because Murray just decided, you know, cooks this his whole story up. And these ladies, the look on their faces, they just couldn't process. And I'm saying, yes, I love mature women. They kiss better. They're better lovers. You know, they'll take good care of me. And those are the kind of shenanigans that we would do on a regular basis, and I never, ever would know what kind of scenario he would put me in.
Fun times.
All right, well, we got to close this show. We'll do another round with you because there's too many stories. So how would you like to close this show out with a story?
I'd like to close the show up is that the best thing that were working was the family that Warner Bros. Created with Bo Austin. That spread down to Russ Sirette, that gave us, and the A&R staff that gave us the music. And we all worked for great people. The management from the top down always wanted us to, you know, be confident, but not cocky, you know, working Warner Brothers.
Right.
And there's a shout out that there was, you know, Ron Saul that worked there. As my first boss, I thank him very much for always bringing me to Warner Brothers. My closest friend that became over the years, my best friend was Russ Sirette that I owe everything to. But there's a young lady there that survived all three regimes, and her name's Carol Hart. And to this day, she was the glue at that place.
Yeah, she was.
I mean, dealing with, you know, all the people there and their idiosyncrasies, she was the glue.
She was.
But, you know, the A&R staff, I mean, look at the music that was on Warner Brothers. To this day, it's still getting played, you know, on the classic radio. You know, and the amazing thing was, growing up, you listen to the music, and then being in the record business, getting to work with the artist. You know, like from George Harrison, meeting George Harrison that was a Beatle, and you grew up in 65 listening to him, you know? And artists like that, and the Van Morrisons, and Gordon Lightfoots, and Van Halen. I mean, the roster goes on, and Rod Stewart. They were all great artists to work with, and another story was, you know, it was just the best of all times. And for all of us that worked at Warner Brothers, I got to tell you, we were the luckiest people in the world.
We were.
You know, all our faith, we were loyal to each other. Everybody worked as a team because it came down from the company.
Yep.
I mean, we all helped each other. And to this day, we still all talk.
Yep, you know, we do.
Like, you know, we stay in touch with people. I just heard somebody I just called me the other day and talked to in 20 years that starred with me at Warner Brothers in the 70s. And he worked in Minneapolis and stuff like that. So I leave this is the best of times, the best of music. It will never be repeated the way the music industry now is. You know,
true that.
And it's unfortunate because the promotion man was a big part of breaking a lot of records for a lot of these artists that we look back at now and said, wow, I was part of it. And we were all part of it. So
thank you, Murray.
I thank everybody that I worked with and all the musicians and everything else that gave me a great life to live.
Thanks, Murray. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it, man.